Now, so we're looking at Anthony Comstock around 1872 when he came onto the national stage. For the next 40 years or more, he would be the chief watchdog protecting America from obscenity. I need to ask now, can you hear me in back? Am I too loud in front? I'm actually yelling at myself right here. Between that and that, what can I say? So at this point, he was a 29-year-old clerk living in New York. He was, like many clerks, a migrant from Connecticut. The New York YMCA sent him to Washington to lobby for a new law banning obscenity through the mail. Thus, when the law passed, it was nicknamed the Comstock Law. It was officially the 1873 Federal Act for, quote, the suppression of trade in and circulation of obscene articles, obscene literature, and articles of immoral use. What it did was the following three things. It made it illegal to send through the mail erotica, contraceptive materials, substances intended to cause an abortion, sexual implements, contraceptive information, advertisement for contraception or abortion. This is a powerful list. Secondly, it strengthened the U.S. Postal Service by giving it broad and vague powers. And thirdly, it gave judges the power to issue warrants for search and seizure and the destruction of the materials that were found. Now, another federal bill which made its way through Congress made Comstock the federal agent of the post office, able to make arrests. Here his power and that of the post office grew. He served in this position until his death in 1915. One of his last acts before he died was to arrest Margaret Sanger, the birth control reformer. My task this evening is to help you understand how this law came into being. And it has a number of themes. The law was the work of powerful men of the YMCA of New York City who effectively used and employed Anthony Comstock. When the law was passed, it seemed not to be about birth control or contraception at all, but about obscenity. And of course, this had a profound effect on sexual knowledge in women's bodies. The impact of this law was great and lasting. Much of what is in the Sky Collection was at the time of its creation and sale contraband. At one level, my goal is to help you understand why obscenity became an important issue and how its regulation changed the conversation about sex in this country and limited human freedom. So I need to begin in a different era. In the period 1830 to 1870, when the conversation about sex in the United States was many-voiced and quite open. I want to start first with the notion of conversation. In my Smith College classrooms, I constantly face students who carry block images. The 1920s is the flapper in conservative politics, for example. But times are always more complex than this. The progressives of the 1910s didn't just die in the 20s. They were there, and they were battling it out or lying low waiting for a better day, the day that was going to come in the 1930s and the New Deal. So this is true when you think about approaches to sex in the 19th century and today. To examine the many statements in books and pamphlets about sex in the years between 1830 and 1870 is to see several basic approaches. And I hear those approaches as voices in a conversation. Briefly, they involve folk or popular tradition, the earthly acceptance of desire and sexual expression, such as you find in Aristotle's masterpiece. And you'll see this in the Sky Collection. It's actually turned to one of the earthier, more earthy pages. In this work and in others, blood and other fluids of the body are central. Heat and blood are the sources of sexual desire. Emphasis is put on sharp arousal and quick release in sexual intercourse. Some folk understandings and language have a long life. Take the word hot, for example, to signify sexual desire. And the folk understandings are really the source of much body and erotic writing 19th century to today. Secondly, there are prohibitions from the pulpit and printed page by Protestant leaders such as the preacher Lyman Beecher. He, by the way, was the great-grandfather of the subject I'm working on now, Charlotte Perkins Gilman. Lust, in his eyes, became a preeminent deadly sin. Its fiery rages threatened body and spirit. The proponents of this view are committed to childhood ignorance about sexuality, and they extend this to women until marriage. Thirdly, there's a popular science of the body found in works by medical doctors and amateur physiologists, and the collection upstairs has many of these works that you will see. These works of popular science focus now on the nervous system as central to an understanding of sexual functioning and desire. They see the sexual body as less plumbing and more electrical connections. Many who wrote popular science were committed to sexual education of children, including that of girls. A few of the writers of these books and lecturers were early women's rights proponents, such as Paulina Davis and the important writer on health, Mary Gove. By 1830s, all of these three voices were in the air, and by the 1850s, they were joined by a fourth voice, one that argued that sex was actually at the very center of life. This voice grew out of the popular science of the time, and while its the proponents' numbers were few, it was very important in terms of the way the sexual conversation was to move. Mary Gove and Thomas Nichols, who represented this voice, move us to our own time and to the weight we place on sexual identity. Now, these ideas in written texts affect the complex and conflicted world of behaviors and feelings, but I would never argue that the relation between ideas and conversations and feelings is straightforward. It's really quite complex. And in addition, history doesn't stay static. It's always having to respond to change, to new events. In this case, the sexual conversation of the 19th century was complicated by a new phenomena that was emerging in cities. And this was the creation of male sporting culture. So I want to take you now to New York City in the 1840s. And this is just a slide of an important square in New York. We know that men in groups act in a certain way often, have a culture, like fraternity men. This is something that a woman knows implicitly. Ask any young woman walking down the street by a bar, a fraternity house, or even a construction project. Now, next slide. I've been interested in the way this particular form took place in the early 19th century around commercial leisure. And here you just have a bunch of young working men out on the street and in the windows, and you can see them in the printing establishments where they worked. The style of some of these young men in their leisure had a certain swagger, and it was passed on to succeeding generations. I've looked particularly at the weekly sporting papers published in New York City, and this particular one actually in Boston. The primary purpose of these sporting papers, and I wrote about this with two others in the Flash Press book, was to entertain and guide future sporting men about the new world of unrestricted pleasure and commercialized leisure in the American city. Recently, I published this book, and it contains not only discussions about the book that I and two co-authors wrote, but also a lot of excerpts and a lot of illustrations, a few of which I'm going to be showing you, such as this one, the Pewter Mug, which was a tavern. And this came, this shows you a man holding one of the papers in his hand. And if you look closely, I think it was the paper was called The Rake. So the publishers of these papers took advantage of a new market, young, literate men moving to the city for opportunity. In the years between 1800 and 1850, New York's population grew 750%. Some of these were immigrants from abroad. Some came from New England and upstate New York. And the need for clerks in the city brought many literate young men hoping to rise in the world. Although these clerks worked hard during the day, they were free after hours, and they lived in boarding houses, which were unsupervised. Some of them turned to the new opportunities available in the city, including the sporting papers. And so when we look at this male sporting culture that emerged around the boarding houses, we see an imagined sexuality. In its fiction, men seek to get what they can. This is New York by gaslight, that's a prostitute flying the streets. As men seek to get what they can, money, sex, power, they do so without the burden of religion, ethical values, or responsibilities in this imagined world. Male heroes are limited only by others, their aggressiveness, their capacity for revenge. The prostitute is the perfect sexual partner, for she brings with her no responsibility. This is a cartoon of a contest where several famous prostitutes supposedly took part. The prostitute also is important because, as we know from the murder of Helen Jewett, prostitution and the use of prostitutes could be linked with violence. And in the imagined novels and stories that evolved around prostitution and this male world, there's a great deal of violence. The voice in this imagined world has echoes of the folk world. It uses such terms as hot blood, but it's now part of commercial culture, eager to make a buck. So it's this world that we find in these sporting papers and in the erotica sold on the streets. That these sexualized materials seem to some women to pose a threat should be quite clear. But they also pose a threat to some men who, for a range of reasons, political, religious, ethical, social, were deeply offended by this literature. And they are the critical actors in one realm, the courts. And it is the courts that begin to judge this material obscene. So let me talk to you about the law in the courts. One thing that I discovered in my work on this material is the power of the common law, derived from England, which wore a deep groove in American legal practice. This is important because the common law is subversive to the rights of free speech and expression. The common law was useful to conservatives and to evangelical Christians, because through the courts, their voice, the second voice of prohibition, became the legal voice. Male judges and juries were certainly aware of sporting culture, may even have joined in it secretly in past or present, but they had to deny its legitimacy. So they fought against its most public expressions, especially cheap literature on the street. The flash papers that I studied were suppressed by the New York City courts in 1942 and 43. Versions of them revived, and in one form or another, pornography of this kind has a life that continues today. Now, New York, the clerks, these men were important in another way. There were a group of evangelical businessmen who in 1852 created the YMCA of New York City. I think I need to emphasize that these men were worrying about men. Particularly, these were businessmen who were worrying about the young clerk, the way that he and his peers were led into a world of gambling, saloons, brothels, and in private, into the world of masturbation. So when they came together, they sought through the YMCA to create an alternative place of moral amusements. And early on, they began to focus on erotic literature and began a fight against obscenity. First of all, the obscenity sold on the streets. During the Civil War, this is the kind of erotica that was sold on the streets. Unfortunately, I don't have an illustrated version. You just see the cover. Now, the Civil War is important because it brings, well, first of all, there's the whole creation of volunteer armies, and the Y became very involved in that in New York City, and of course it brings to New York a lot of soldiers as well. And in the war, the leaders of the New York YMCA experienced the increasing power of the federal government. These men were leaders in the creation of the Christian Commission. Now, this Christian Commission served the troops of the Union Army, and it brought ministers, Bibles, books, and food to Union troops. In 1865, the Christian Commission got the first federal law making it illegal to send erotica through the mail. And here the focus was on protecting the young soldier. And you can see upstairs in the collection why that was an issue, because there is an example of what was sent through the mail. So this law that was gotten during wartime to protect the soldier against erotic materials that would lead him either to masturbation or to prostitution, this law was codified and became known as Section 148. But for the men of the YMCA, who in the Christian Commission guys and the Christian Commission hats got this law, it wasn't strong enough. They were working at the same time on the New York state level to get laws against obscenity. And when we ask that critical question, how did contraception get included among obscenity, written obscenity, then you have to turn to this New York state law because it's critical. In the federal statute of 1865, or in its codification in 1872, what is known as Section 148, prescription of contraception is not there. At no place was obscene or the words vulgar and indecent modified to include contraception, information regarding contraception, or advertisements for abortion. And a critical element of the later law, the right of search and seizure, also wasn't there. Both appear in the 1868 New York state law. And here the role of the YMCA of New York City is paramount. Its leaders worked hard in the state to get the law passed, and then they created a commission to oversee enforcement and arrests. But I need to now to take a step back. Historians, particularly right now, when they imagine the second half of the 19th century, see it as a time in which the United States became increasingly secular, particularly under the influence of Darwin and Darwinianism. In addition, economic historians have shown us about the strength of industrial society after the Civil War. It's more accurate, I think, to see the period as a time of increasing conflict between religious and secular forces. For the era also saw intense efforts to define the United States as a Christian nation. Now, usually the way that when this is talked about, we turn to women, we see the WCTU, but I'm going to talk again about men. And I'm going to take you to the dark moment in 1863, when Northerners felt that they were going to lose the Civil War. And a group of Northern Christian men from 11 Protestant denominations gathered in Xenia, Ohio, not far from Dayton, with an explanation of the national crisis and a plan. They believed that God was angry, that the nation had placed itself on such a secular foundation. They couldn't establish a state religion, particularly given their many competing Protestant sects, but they believed that the nation should dedicate itself to God. They believed that the way was to inscribe the United States as a Christian nation through a constitutional amendment that declared, and I'm going to quote, Almighty God as the source of all authority and power in civil government, the Lord Jesus Christ as his ruler among the nations and his will, revealed in Holy Scriptures as supreme authority. Powerful denominations backed this, including Presbyterians and Methodists, and it attracted strong support among college heads, particularly in the area where I teach, the Pioneer Valley. So they created something called the National Reform Association to push this amendment, and they appointed William Strong to be president of the organization. 3 years later, he became a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. Now remember that. The amendment failed. The men shifted their tactics. So instead of going after this amendment, which wasn't going to pass, you go after it in different ways. What comes to mind? Prohibition, it took a long time to get there, but also the campaign against obscenity. That's another way. So, in New York City, as the YMCA was gearing up after the war, and I do this to show you how rich and powerful they were. This is the YMCA building in New York City that went up right after the war. At the same time they were doing this, they were redefining their purposes and dedicating themselves to the fight against obscenity in the city and beyond. They had a clear notion of what it was. It was printed erotica, writing or illustrations offered for general sale to the public in relatively inexpensive editions and marketed to suggest that it had the power of sexually arousing its readers. So they had a report and they hired an agent to investigate, and then they found out that there wasn't any real law to suppress it, and there was no, they appointed a committee to draw it up, and this goes on for a while. And they find out that 20 states actually had criminal statutes against obscenity. So New York seemed really deficient. And so they began to develop a bill and to lobby for it in Albany, New York. It was passed. It failed to pass initially, and then they worked again. In the law that they began to work on, they linked birth control and abortifacients with erotica. They proposed a change in the state's penal code that prohibited advertisements and the sale of cures for venereal disease, restoring menstruation, procuring miscarriages, along with obscene exhibitions, books, and prints. And they added search and seizure. It didn't pass. But in 1868, it did. And I've got evidence that they used really intimidation methods to get the state legislatures, who weren't particularly interested in passing this law, to embarrass them so that they felt they were obligated to pass this law because they didn't want to put themselves on record against it, even if they opposed it. So the association appointed a committee to oversee the enforcement of the law, and its members began to act as detectives to secure arrests. So you have YMCA guys going around the city making citizens' arrests. So what I want to argue is that the language that you find in the federal statute that was introduced in 1872 and passed in 1873, this language follows very closely the language of the New York statute of just a few years earlier, which was pushed by the YMCA. So let me tell you about Anthony Comstock. We'll get back to him. He entered the picture in 1872. So the New York guys have been at work since 1852. 20 years later, he comes on the scene. The New York guys have gotten, in 1868, they've gotten the New York Bill. In 1872, he starts making arrests, citizens' arrests, and goes to the YMCA for backing. He's a 29-year-old clerk. He's not doing very well economically. And he began private vigilante actions against first saloons open on Sunday against the law, and then against obscene literature sold on the streets. And once he started that, he went to the YMCA for support. One of his first projects was to take on Victoria Woodhull, a fabulous character. She was a spiritualist, a women's rights advocate, stockbroker, the first woman to run for president of the United States. And she and her sister put out a weekly newspaper, Woodhull and Claflin's Weekly. It was quite radical. It was the first to publish in the United States the English translation of Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto. In 1872, when she was down on her luck, and of course Comstock was down on his, she published the Beecher-Tilton scandal case. So this is one of Lyman Beecher's sons, great uncle of Charlotte Perkins Gilman, and the woman he most likely had an affair with, Elizabeth Tilton. This publication in her weekly newspaper detailed this adulterous affair. And Elizabeth Tilton wasn't just anybody. She was the wife of Theodore Tilton, who was Beecher's foremost champion at the time. So Comstock, believing that this was obscene, had her arrested for sending obscenity through the mail. It turned out that the law was such that she got off, and that made Comstock all the madder. Essentially, the YMCA of New York hired Comstock and paid his bills to become their chief lobbyist in Washington, D.C. And that's why the bill, when it's passed, is called the Comstock Bill. His later reflections and his writings about his life and work tended to play down the YMCA's role. But in fact, it was the key members of the YMCA who championed him and saw the need for him to broaden his work and for a federal law to strengthen his hand. So they took as their model for the federal law, the 1868 law, and in winter 1873, YMCA leader Morris Jessup paid for Comstock to travel to Washington as a lobbyist to seek the stiffer obscenity law. I wanted you to see him because that shows you what a prosperous man in New York looks like. He's a business leader in New York as well. Some individual directors of the Y did have some doubts about Comstock's publicity seeking, especially his pursuit of Victoria Woodhull. But as a body, the New York City YMCA backed Comstock. What sustained him when he got to Washington was, of course, their power and prestige, the role they had played in the Christian Commission, the role that they had played in getting the first anti-obscenity federal law in 1865, and their economic and political power in New York State. So they drafted a new federal bill and sought its passage, and it was sponsored by a New York State representative. Comstock met with members of the House of Representatives, and he set up an exhibit of obscene materials to prove his point. It was a ripe moment. Congress at this point was distracted by the Credit Mobilier scandal and pressed by the need to adjourn before Grant's second inauguration. Comstock was advised and supported by his New York YMCA allies, and he planned a smart campaign. He and the New York YMCA actually got William Strong, now a justice of the Supreme Court, to get involved in drafting the Comstock, what became the Comstock Law. And this is, of course, after he had lost his battle to get God put in the Constitution. What he had probably understood was that this bill was one of the ways to achieve some of his religious goals in a secular frame. So Strong introduced Comstock to a powerful member of the Senate, who then introduced the bill. Comstock got to use the room in the Capitol of the Vice President, who, as you know, presides over the Senate, who was long known as a friend of the New York YMCA. And there in that Vice President's room, he set up another exhibit of his confiscated obscene materials. He explained that they were being sent to children in boarding schools. As Comstock wrote in his diary, after viewing his exhibit, all were very much excited. We're talking about senators. All were very much excited and declared themselves ready to give me any law I might ask for if it was only within the bounds of the Constitution. So, in a coordinated move, backers began to insert a provision in a federal appropriations bill working its way through Congress. In it lay the seeds of Comstock's greatly enlarged powers for the future. Because in this bill, Congress authorized a new position, special agent of the United States Post Office, with power to confiscate immoral matter in the mails and arrest those sending it. The office was created with the understanding that this lobbyist, Anthony Comstock, would fill it. In late February of 1873, right before adjournment, without any substantive debate, the bill passed the Senate and the House. President Grant signed it March 3, 1873. It's important to know that this law, the Comstock Law, had virtually no debate. The campaign that surrounded it, that was waged, was all about children, how to protect them from receiving printed obscene materials through the mails, what we would call pornography, protecting them while they were away from home in boarding schools. The powerful provision to outlaw contraception or abortion advertisements were never even mentioned in the debate about the bill. The impact of the Comstock Law of 1873 was profound. It made it illegal to send through the mail erotica, contraceptive materials, substances intended to cause abortion, sexual implements, contraceptive information, advertisements for contraception or abortion. It strengthened the U.S. Postal Service by giving it broad and vague powers. It gave judges the power to issue warrants for search and seizure and the destruction of materials found. It led to the writing of state laws that mirrored it in many respects and extended criminal activity from sending through the mails, which meant across state lines or in the federal mails, to the sale of all contraception. So it made illegal the sale, which is a state matter, by another federal bill, of course. Comstock became that federal agent. He served until his death in 1815, arresting Margaret Sanger right before he died. This just shows you, and you'll see another copy of that, and I wonder if it's... No, it's not, but it's same kind of imagery here. You'll see this up in the exhibit. This was a part of Comstock's self-advertisement in the book he wrote. And you see these immoral gentlemen putting the materials in the mail. Oh, perhaps they were moral. You see all the things that lottery, all the things that shouldn't be obscene right here. And you see this sporting man taking it out. That hat is a dead giveaway. Now, what you need to know is that the enforcement of this meant that people who mailed erotic materials, advertisements for contraception, contraceptive articles, abortion services, advertisements, these people were arrested, fined, and jailed. It's interesting that under the mirroring state laws, sellers of contraceptives, such as pharmacists, were arrested, but typically juries let them off. That gives you some sense of when the people spoke. The real victims were writers of that popular science of the body, that reform physiology that I talked about, who either discussed contraception in their work or wrote in a manner that Comstock and evangelical Christians regarded as obscene. What this means is that for decades, there would be no public discussion, nothing written, put in print about sex education or marriage reform or, dare I say, free love. So, with such scope, it's bound that resistance developed. And let's talk about this a bit. Who were the resistors? Were they the women who were the most profoundly affected by the Comstock Law? It was their reproductive rights that were being taken away. Did they fight? Well, Victoria Woodhull did. She fought openly against Comstock, against his hypocrisy about sex education. But at this point, she was a controversial, polarizing figure among women's rights advocates. I think if you back up one, we might get an image of what... I guess I decided to take it off as a distraction. The larger women's rights movement at the time was quite divided about sexual matters, as well as about pushing for a woman's suffrage amendment in the Reconstruction amendments to the Constitution. Because of the support of the New York group headed by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, a Boston group broke away and created a much more conservative society, the American Woman Suffrage Associations, which remained quiet on all sexual matters. The Susan B. Anthony group pressed sexual issues for a time and then began to focus on a national amendment and on organizing working women. So with both organizations, after 1874, sexual matters were not on the public agenda of women's rights advocates. So who then fought openly and directly? It was not the vendors of erotica or sellers of contraceptive devices or abortionists. They continued their work, but now they had to operate in the shadows. To be sure, there remained a lively commerce in contraceptive materials, and it grew. You'll see evidence of that in the exhibit upstairs. But it was put on the black market. It was unregulated, and it could not be discussed in public prints. Let it be said that in this commercial underground, women also played their parts as advisors, sellers of contraception, and providers of abortion. What is most important is that the real opposition emerged in a group of persons who for the first time began to focus on the issue of First Amendment freedoms, which are so critical in terms of freedom of speech. They call themselves liberals. They included lawyers and writers who were opposing this Christianization of American government. And they also included an established writer of works on popular health, Dr. Edward Bliss Foote. Let's see if I have one. Oh, there's the Victoria Woodhull.
They were just a little bit out of order.
And that seeing her as the devil, you saved by free love, and you see a woman carrying on her back a drunken husband and all her children.
Okay. And then I wanted you to see Edward Bliss Foote. By this, he was arrested by Comstock in 1876. By this time, he was a wealthy man, a best-selling writer on physiology, and a practicing physician in New York City. His crime was mailing a pamphlet on contraception at a reader's request. Found guilty, he was sentenced to 10 years, but the sentence was suspended because of all these people who were saying, "You can't put my doctor in jail. I need him." He was ordered to pay a very large fine. But he was given a suspended sentence, and this meant that he was effectively censored. One of the things that's often said is, we don't have censorship in this country. You can write anything you want. We can just arrest you afterwards. But if you have a suspended sentence, what would happen is if he wrote something that came before a judge who judged that it was obscene, he would have to serve that 10-year sentence. So he was effectively censored. He was silenced in this aspect of his medical writing, but he came to defend others who were writing on health, birth control, and sex reform when they were arrested under the Comstock Law and didn't have his resources. With others, he created an organization called the National Defense Association, and they defended those unjustly brought before the courts, and they worked for modification of the laws. This was the first beginning of a counter-movement of organized resistance, and it eventually led to the creation of the American Civil Liberties Union after World War I and the ACLU's defense of First Amendment protections. These forces had a very large struggle, and women play a very active part and successful part here. It was not until 1929 that a successful battle was waged for books of sex education. And this is for Mary Ware Dennett's The Sex Side of Life. In 1932, the battle was waged and won for certain works of creative literature. Random House essentially took this case to legalize the importation of James Joyce's Ulysses. It was only in 1965, with Griswold versus Connecticut, that there was the beginning of the court's establishment of the right to contraception, and in 1973, Roe v. Wade, the right of a woman to abortion. But as you know as well as I, the conflicts that began in the 19th century are far from resolved today. So from this, what do I hope? I hope you get a sense of the historical perspective and some sense of the nature of the fight that was waged around the Comstock Law and the forces that were engaged in that fight. I hope you get a sense that there was a broader cultural conversation in the society before 1873. So if there is a Victorianism, it doesn't start until then. And that this is highly complicated and compromised by a male sporting culture, with the commercialization of opportunities both to sell erotica and sex on the streets, that the common law was used and was very powerful. And I have to say that one piece of my work has been to show how when the Comstock Law was used to shut down publishers of erotic materials or of contraceptive information, what they relied on were the grooves made in the common law before there was ever any statutory law. And so that the traditions that were established with the sporting press cases in 1840s lead directly to the court's actions in the 1870s, at least, as the early cases were tried. You'll be happy to know that when the Supreme Court was asked to weigh in on this, William Strong was on the court, of course, and the court did support the 1873 law by extension of the law, federal law against lotteries. The resistance that develops, there, of course, is an underground resistance of users and sellers of contraceptive materials, but the resistance that attempts to counter the silences that are imposed by the Comstock Law are very public, and they come ultimately to rely successfully on the First Amendment protections to free speech. One of my favorite historians, Kathy Pice of the University of Pennsylvania, has thought about the way that history simultaneously both distances us and connects us with what we study. History, she writes, is the relationship between past and present. Thus, the history of sexuality illuminates ourselves and contributes a significant perspective to contemporary debates about sexual matters. So I thank you.